everyone, and welcome back to the Developmentor podcast. This is season one, episode five. I'm your host, Grant Ingersoll, and today I'm excited to have my co-author from the Taming textbook, Drew Ferris, on the show. Despite the long and laborious process that it is to write a book, Drew does indeed still talk to me, which I am quite thankful for. In the future, I will definitely do an episode on writing, but today I want to focus in on someone who has quite successfully gone from a background in visual arts and computer graphics into software engineering and then through big data consulting and data science. Please welcome to the show, Drew Ferris. Drew, great to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Grant.
Yeah, why don't we just start off, Drew, give our listeners kind of an introduction to you and your career, some of the background, some of the problems you've worked on over the years.
Yeah. So I've had a pretty varied career, actually. And I didn't have much of an idea that I'd sort of be where I was if you had talked to, you know, Drew Ferris 25 years ago when I was finishing up undergrad. I guess the easiest thing to start off is sort of describing what I'm doing now, and then maybe I'll hop back to the path that I took to get here.
Perfect.
Yeah, great. So I'm a technology consultant, right? Sort of equally spending my time as a software engineer and data scientist for a large consulting firm, Booz Allen Hamilton. And in my role, I'm sort of doing about 70% direct work interacting with clients and 30% sort of focused internally into building our technical capabilities of the company, right? But what it really comes down to is that on a day-to-day basis, I'm still writing code. And I think that's been sort of an important goal for me throughout my career. Sort of instead of a more traditional technical path may have been, you know, start off as a software developer, then begin running some projects, and then sort of gradually transform into sort of a management or leadership role. And while I'm definitely leading initiatives and efforts and things like that, I feel glad that I'm sort of still involved in the nitty gritty. And I think that's been sort of an important goal of mine and an important theme of mine throughout my career.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I know I've struggled with that question as well. I think, you know, especially as we grow in experience in technology, there's constantly this, hey, you know, maybe you should run this project, maybe you should manage people, and yet at your heart, you're a technologist, so you want to have your hands dirty, if as it were. What then do you see as kind of some of the key skills that have helped you in that career?
Yeah, so being able to dive into something that's very technical myself and learn something new. And it's learning in all sorts of different ways, right? A lot of it is predicated on hands-on experience, right? You can go and read things on the internet. You can read documentation. You can listen to lectures or talk to people about the technologies that they are working with. But when it really comes down to it, you know, sitting there, you know, with a terminal on your screen and trying to figure out what those first steps are is an important first step towards sort of understanding sort of any technology, right? So, and it's something that I feel like I'm constantly doing. And it's almost like, you know, some people have a rigorous physical workout schedule. I sort of feel like I always have to make time, especially to always keep my technical skills up to date.
Yeah, and I imagine I find, especially these days in the realm of data science and artificial intelligence, natural language processing, I mean, there's a new project every week. And I imagine as a consultant here, you know, you've got some really interesting challenges because you have to go interface with clients. So mm-hmm. You kind of have to have, you know, the shiny, happy face, right, in many ways of where you're engaging. You have to sometimes play politics. Sometimes mm-hmm. You have to just negotiate. But at the same time, you also have this background process running that's like, okay, I got to go learn what this new project is, what this new idea is that's coming out, whether that's deep learning or whatever it is. Like, fill me in a little bit. How do you manage those things? How do you kind of slice your time across all of those different skills?
Well, yeah, that's what I've got to say. As a consultant, you have to have a really broad set of skills, right? And typically the way we like to talk about it is consultants have, you know, everything from communication to understanding the business aspects of a problem to the technical aspects of a problem. So they have a really broad horizontal skill set, right? But then in a couple areas, we like to see people with deep skills in certain things, whether it be a specific domain expertise or specific technical approaches and things like that, right? And in consulting, I think especially, people are looking to you to be an expert, right? They're looking at you because you have existing experience in an area and you are not going to be, for lack of a better term, a dilettante about technology, right? You're not going to follow necessarily the latest trends or anything like that. You're actually going to propose a solution to them, especially in technology consulting, that gives them a return on their investment, and that is not exactly what I would call a risky solution, or at least if you are engendering risk in your technical approaches, you're able to qualify that risk to make sure the clients understand that, oh, this may be a little bit experimental, but it has the potential to return big wins, right? So that's why it's important to know the technology, right? Because you fundamentally need to know what will work and what won't work instead of just sort of winging it, so to speak.
Right. And I would imagine that, you know, when you're thinking about risk, it's really about what is the level of risk that this project or this client can tolerate, right? If you're on if this is groundbreaking work, then of course it's all risk. Whereas if this is, hey, you know, we just need this thing to work and it's a smaller feature and a part of a bigger engine, then like it just better be rock solid.
Right, right. And that's sort of like the role of research and experimentation in a consulting firm in general, right? Like, very, very often these firms are sort of very customer, very billable work driven. And I'm of a mind that any organization that's sort of built that way just can't sustain themselves on that, because they need to maintain that cutting edge, need to be continually expanding their capabilities. But wow, this is really interesting. We're talking about a big, big question, and maybe we can bring it back to talk about my career path a little bit, if that makes sense.
that would be great, actually. I mean, and I think one of the things that's intrigued me, I've known you for a long time, and you know, looking on your resume, you got this degree in I think media fine arts and computer graphics way back when from Syracuse University. So you mentioned kind of 18-year-old Drew or 22-year-old Drew, you know, coming fresh out with this, hey, I love this visual stuff. And here you are doing data science, which of course has a visualization. How is that, that background, that visual aspect of your brain, if you will, played out throughout your career and perhaps helped you in ways that maybe traditional software engineers don't necessarily think about?
Yeah, there's a bunch of different things that sort of converged to position me where I am or where I was earlier in my career as well, right? So I'd say the first thing is I've always sort of been a visual thinker and sometimes struggled with more abstract things that I could not visualize effectively in my head, right? So a great example with high dimensional representations of data and things like that, like you would look at in machine learning, you know, it's hard for me to reason about things that are n dimensions, you know, 7, 12, whatever. But, you know, if I can use PCA or something like that to collapse something to 3 or 2 dimensions, that really helps me get a visual understanding of the relationships within the data. So this visual trend has been something like that's been with me, you know, since I was a kid. You know, and in terms of technology, you know, being positioned, you know, very early on with access to computer resources to learn things was also a key pit right there.
And I would imagine it, you know, especially as a consultant, you know, a chunk of what you've just described is there's this storytelling component. And of course, you know, having strong visual skills is one of the keys to better storytelling.
Right. And the thing that I've always really appreciated the ability to do is the ability to take really complex technical concepts and distill them down into explainable concepts. Like, and I like looking at things that, like reading things that where people do that, exactly that, right? You know, there's been a number of different books that I've read, you know, that are about, you know, explaining, putting complex concepts simply, right? And I sort of like this interpretive role, playing this interpretive role for the folks that I work with as well. So, you know, when I was in high school, it wasn't really clear for me that I would be on that sort of computer science track, for instance. Like, while, you know, talking about the visual, you know, visual aspects of thinking, I was really, really great at things like geometry and other sort of maths that required spatial reasoning. But I'm not, I tended to struggle, or it was a little bit, required more work for more complex maths. And as a result, it didn't seem like a computer science track at the time, and based on the way people thought of computer science at the time, was the best path for me forward. So I actually ended up taking a lot of art classes, a lot of actually mechanical drawing, like drafting classes, and where I got, you know, exposed to things like CAD and sort of mm-hmm. continued this visual trend. That actually led to me pursuing architecture in the early days of my undergrad. So I was in architecture school for about 2.5 years. And the thing I struggled with there was that there was not enough of a technology focus at that particular time. You know, if we're thinking back in the early 90s when I was going through architecture school, this notion of computational architecture or procedurally generated architecture was not even something most people thought about, whereas now it's sort of commonplace. So I think I was maybe a little bit ahead of my time in architecture school, which is why I ended up graduating towards the School of Computer Graphics at Syracuse and ended up getting my Bachelor of Fine Arts from there. But there's one thing about architecture school that was outstanding. I got exposed to this thinking process. And of course, it's now sort of codified in this notion of design thinking. But it's really a way to approach problem solving and taking a wide variety of different perspectives into account, a lot of different conditions into account when coming up with solutions to problems. And I think this is very important for has been a theme throughout my career. It's been really important for the way that I attack problems. So I'd say that design thinking experience in architecture school was really useful.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I just, in fact, for our listeners, one of the books that I just recently read, I'm kind of new to the design thinking view of the world. I just read a great book called Designing Your Life, which is essentially applying design thinking to your career and your life, and this notion of prototyping and trying things out and then seeing what works and then backing off and trying another one. It's been actually super helpful for me in answering some of these questions I've been going through, like that you mentioned, of how do I balance this need for growth in my career with the technical underpinnings of it, the things that give me most joy, whereas with the things that perhaps other people value in you. Mm-hmm. And trying to find that balance. Let's perhaps unpack that a little bit more with you. You know, you've very purposefully stated that, you know, you wanted to maintain this very technical role, mm-hmm. right? And yep. then, of course, we all have, you know, for the most part, desires to grow in our career, which is typically a management path, especially at, you know, a bigger firm. You know, it's kind of this go climb the career ladder. Like, how do you think about, you know, your personal growth, keeping that technical boundary, but also, hey, you know, making more money or getting more status in the company or whatever it is that guides you that way?
Yeah, I think it sort of ties back to being that interpreter, that visionary. For me personally, I think folks see value in my ability to keep up with what's coming, what's next, how is the world going to change as a result of the development growth of technology and the way people use it, right? Mm-hmm. So in a way, that begins to sound almost like a futurist, but I don't think I quite call myself one of those yet, or maybe I don't have my chops enough to call myself a futurist. Also, you know, I feel like, you know, I'm maybe not as big of a thinker as some of the futurists that I can think of, and I respect, you know, like Buckminster Fuller and stuff like that, right? So I'm definitely much more of a
practical futurist.
Practical futurist or something like that, right? Also, while I am, I tend to stay close to the cutting edge, but I don't know that I'm individually pushing the bleeding edge, right? I'm facilitating folks doing groundbreaking research, and I, you know, in one of my roles, I don't feel like I'm necessarily doing stuff that is I'm more sort of looking at what's available out there, as opposed to pushing the cutting edge myself. At least that's what I feel. But in a way, we have an important role. Like folks who do these sorts of things really have an important role in terms of sharing what they know as well. I feel like I don't see just learning things, learning new things and getting experience with new things, and not somehow giving back as a viable career path. So I think that's maybe part of it too, and that's part of my value, not just as a subject matter expert, but the fact that I am, I try to make connections between people and the technology that they need, and try to help people develop themselves, develop their expertise. That's really valuable, right? Because a company cannot just run on a handful of experts. It's really a matter of growing expertise throughout a firm. So
it's like you're giving me an advertisement for Developmentor, right? Because this is exactly what a number of the guests I've had on already. This is a consistent theme of people growing, and I know in my own career too, right? Is like this ability to communicate and facilitate between different groups, different projects, different ideas, making connections is one of the keys to, I think, a successful career at the end of the day. And it also can be really quite satisfying, especially for people who like to engage with others. You know, not everybody is that way, but you know, for those who are, that it's just a natural thing, and it's not something you typically see in software engineering, or at least the traditional stereotypical view of software engineering. Let's shift gears. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And you know, I think just sort of on that note, I mean, for folks that are software engineers that don't really feel great about engaging with other folks, I would encourage you to develop that skill a little bit. I've got to say, like, when I look at how I'm developing myself, you know, there's some part of it where I'm just doing things that I love to do, right? And then there's some part of it where I'm doing things that make me feel a little bit uncomfortable. And I feel like if I'm not challenging myself and doing these things that make me feel a little bit uncomfortable, I'm probably not progressing in a broad sense, right? So yeah. A great example of that is I really hated public speaking. You know, earlier on in my career, I hated getting up in front of people, in front of audiences, right? But once again, I felt like I had this obligation to share what I knew, and that the stuff that I knew was valuable, or people had suggested that. So I really pushed myself to get up out there and speak. And the only way you can get better at public speaking is through practice. So
yeah, that very first talk you give is just nerve-wracking. And then you realize, you know, hey, you're the person up there doing it, not them. You took the leap. That is often the critical difference of that just desire to say, you know what, I'm going to plow through this. I'm going to do it and get over the first hump. And it just gets easier. Well, it gets easier until the crowds get bigger and bigger, right?
Yeah. And a great way to sort of help that is to actively seek feedback from others, right? So,
yeah.
Go talk to a friend. They'll give you information. They'll give you feedback in terms of how you did or how you can make yourself better.
Yeah, and sometimes it's even just talking in front of your peers at, you know, at your work or things like that.
Yeah, that's true too.
Yeah,
that's true too.
Let's touch a little bit on, you know, I mean, so we talked about kind of these conversations and public speaking. I mean, a couple of other things you've been involved in. Obviously, we wrote a book together.
Yeah,
maybe touching on writing a book, and then, well, let me just start with that. You know, how has that been a benefit? Like, this is, again, not an area typical software engineer does, is go out and publish as well. And I imagine it's a lot like the public speaking side of it, but perhaps, you know, reflect a little bit on what it meant and how you work through writing a book or contributing to a book.
Wow. Yeah. That's a big question. And there's lots to share. I mean, the first and foremost, the thing that first comes to my mind whenever I talk to somebody about writing a book, or they're asked me about what the process was like, is it's not a money-making proposition, right? let's just be blank. If Frank, you know, it's kind of funny. I was talking to my daughter about it because, one of my royalty statements came in and I did the math, and it's really like, I think it's something on the order of 60 cents a copy or something like that. But, you know, we've done all right. We've sold about a little over 10,000 copies, which is pretty cool. And anyway, you know, I can digress. I'm just surprised it's still selling, which is great. But anyway,
yeah.
It was really rewarding. It was probably one of the more difficult things I've done, because it was a long-term project and it was a labor of love. And once you got everything that was important to communicate in the book, there was a fair amount of, let's see, mechanical stuff to get done as well, right? So yeah. We didn't quite self-publish, but we had a pretty deep responsibility when it came to doing things like formatting the code segments and comments and stuff like that. Bottom line, it was a really great experience, and there's nothing more rewarding actually than seeing that physical copy of the book, getting feedback about people who've really enjoyed the book and that it's helped them, and then receiving copies of the book translated into other languages, which is pretty awesome.
So
we have the Korean and Chinese edition of Chaiming Text. I think there's a Russian version somewhere out there.
There is. I actually have a Russian version. I even signed an autograph for a Russian version. So
that's outstanding. So I got to find one of those at some point. But anyway,
the money making side of there is, there certainly are books that can go on and make money, but to me, the money side of it was the indirect impact of,
right,
you know, it helps you become an authority figure, if you will,
right,
or at least a subject expert on it, domain expert on it. So
the folks that I work with, when they bring me into a client, very often like to mention that I wrote a book on text analytics. So very often it's a leading thing, so to speak. But anyway, I think that's good, and it's done very good things for my career. I guess the other piece of advice about book writing that I'd have is that try to write, if you're going to write a technical book, right, which Chaiming Text is definitely a technical book, try to write it about key concepts also that transcend a particular implementation of the technology, right? So a great example is there are tons of ways of thinking about how computers process text. Chaiming Text introduces those sort of foundations and why it's important, but then also shows you some code, which is gravely out of date at this point.
Yeah.
I think that's really, really important because, you know, writing a book about, the latest, NoSQL software database package in itself might be very useful just because people need to learn. And that's one way people learn is from books. But it may not have the sort of staying power. So you might not have as significant a return on investment as to otherwise introducing large concepts.
Yeah, I think the half-life of a technical book, especially on a specific version of software, I think the publisher told me it's like 3 months or 6 months. So you do all this work, and there's this incredible pressure to publish a book like that too, because it has to be timely. And there's a lot of great authors out there who can do that kind of work, and they string together a number of these. But we purposely took a different approach, which was to say, let's try to write something that hits at the concepts and is less about any specific software package. I haven't seen other authors' royalty statements, so I don't know how it plays out. But for us, I think it was the right choice.
Yeah, I think so. I think it made sense. And the other thing is, it made sense. I know that you and I, when we talked about this in the past, is that it sort of reflected a lot of the questions we were being asked as experts on working with text. And so the ability to codify that, I can't tell you how many times somebody has asked me a question and I said, oh, here, read this chapter. And that's great because part of it is about scaling your expertise, right? Like there's only so many hours in a day, right? So there's only so many people you can help, and being able to sort of direct people towards resources that you've already sort of codified and put together is really helpful. So.
Yeah, that's perhaps a perfect segue then, Drew. Let's shift in and I think for our listeners, what are some of the main challenges of your role? Like if all of a sudden you were thrust into this role, what would you want to know about your opportunities and challenges that you face? And let's call it being a consultant or a chief technologist at a consulting firm.
Right. Well, so I joined Booz Allen about 7.5 years ago, and it was the first experience that I had working for a very large company. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about that is that, the way things are sort of broken up in Booz Allen, you feel like you're sort of working for a small company while working for a big company at the same time. But the biggest thing that I sort of struggled with is that now I had this sort of title, very ambiguous, very, you know, sort of standard title, lead associate, right? And
yeah,
I measured myself against the other folks in the company, right? What am I not doing that they're doing? And those sorts of things. How do I fit into this new role was my big question. And I really struggled for a while because the key thing that I didn't understand, especially working in sort of this sort of consulting world, is that everybody has unique talents and strengths. And it's really, really important to embrace that diversity and reward people for their strengths, not necessarily, and reward people for their differences, and not necessarily try to get everybody to fit into the same set of core capabilities or perspectives or something like that. So at first, you know, I struggled for the first 6 months, you know, really feeling like, oh, I was so different from everybody else that I didn't necessarily fit in well. And then I realized, and that was exactly what made me valuable.
Right? Interesting.
Yeah.
That's great. I mean, and I think that underscores a lot of what I'm after here too. In this podcast is showing all the different, you know, contributions people make across different roles to, you know, at the end of the day, delivering technology.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. And understanding that it's a really broad set of disciplines and experiences that you need when doing that, right? It's not just all writing code. It's really about being able to talk to people. It's being able to understand things outside of technology very quickly, dig into a domain and learn about the domain very quickly, but also fundamentally as a technologist, giving back and figuring out ways to expand other people's capabilities.
Yeah, well said. Perhaps then on that note, let's finish up with just one final question here, you know, which is, what advice would you give to somebody who you say, hey, you know, I want to go work at a big four consulting firm, or I want to pursue this consulting angle where I get to blend this mix of people skills and technical skills, you know, what advice would you give them?
Well, there's the great advice is, I mean, I think that it's appropriate for folks at all levels of their career, right? Like it's working at a consulting firm is a great first job out of college because it gets you quickly exposed to a wide variety of different challenges, problems, technologies, you name it. And that's one of the reasons why I'm sort of attracted to it. I have this sort of this desire to always experience a broad set of challenges and things like that. And maybe there are certain individual companies that I could have gone to work for to get exposed to a bunch of different things. But I feel like consulting for me has been really important in that. And that's one of the reasons why sort of I've been around for so long, so to speak. You know, people in some tech careers tend to change every couple years or something like that from one company to another, just because they're looking for fresh challenges. If you like fresh challenges, there's plenty in the sort of consulting field.
So. Yeah, that's fantastic. I that's a lot of my background too, is this kind of liberal arts and go like to do a bunch of different things. So sounds very similar to some of the roles I've done in my career, which is fantastic, Drew. And again, like, I can't thank you enough for being on the show, Drew, and contributing to Developmentor. So thanks again here, Drew.
Awesome. Really, really glad to help too.